So we are continuing with the ninth commandment, well, what we would call the ninth commandment in our tradition, Exodus chapter 20, verse 16. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. Now, I'm sure this is not a new fact to many of you. You probably know that a lot of the First Nations and Indigenous people who live up and around the Arctic Circle have dozens or more words for ice and snow. This is sort of one of those like fun schoolyard facts that kids like to tell each other. So I looked it up online to see if I could learn a little bit about this, and it is indeed true. The Yupik people who live in central northern Siberia have 40 words for different kinds of snow. And the Inuit dialect, which is spoken in Nunavik up in Canada, they have over 53. One of their terms is Matsurati, and that is wet snow that is appropriate for icing a sleigh's runners. They also have a term Pukak, which is crystalline snow that looks as if it is salt. Okay. In Wales, Alaska, the Inuapiaq dialect has 70 different terms for sea ice. And this makes sense because sea ice and the relative safety therein is a life or death phenomena for that community who lives near and sometimes on the sea ice. You want to know, is this ice that you can walk on? Is this ice that you can live on? Is this ice that a sled can go on or a dog could go on? Is this ice that lasts year-round and has never melted? Or is this ice that comes and goes? They have 70 different terms for it. But then my personal favorite, the Sami people live in northern Russia and along the northern edge of Scandinavia. They have 180 words for various kinds of snow and ice, and an additional 1,000 words to discuss different kinds of reindeer, because they are reindeer herders. My personal favorite term for a reindeer is Nijiru, and that means a female reindeer with an unmanageable temperament. I thought that's a really good one. And this is what linguists like to call a linguistic exuberance. And all of our various languages around the world show this. Linguistic exuberance is when you have a whole range of different terms for something that you interact with regularly and frequently. Where we might say snow or ice, and those terms sort of suffice, people who live near and in the snow and the ice and rely on specificity for their own safety will have an exuberance of terms for that. Living with a statistician in my home, I experience the linguistic exuberance of the statistics field every day. If I try to tell John an interesting fact or a piece of data that I read in a book or saw in a newspaper, you should come over and watch what happens next. It's mostly endearing on most days to be corrected ad nauseum by my beloved husband and his linguistic exuberance. And this is, of course, a commandment that is concerned with our words. The words that we speak, the intention behind the words that we speak, our attitude in speaking them, their relative truthfulness one to another. And it's one of those commandments that appears really easy. It's one that is, like, not hard to give a children's message. We don't lie. We use kind words. Okay, great. But the problem is, when you actually start digging into what it means to speak to other people, this is a really complicated, hard commandment to pin down. So at its top level, this commandment is about how our words affect the reputations and the judgment and treatment of other people. So don't lie, don't slander, and literally, like in a court of law, do not commit perjury. Don't say things against your neighbor that are not true. Calvin put this pretty eloquently. He said, "Let us not malign anyone with slander or false charges, or harm their substance by falsehood. In short, injure them by unbridled evil speaking and impudence." I sort of loved that. I thought, yes, that is what this commandment is saying. And then he goes on to explain that there is a literal legal implication to this commandment. This commandment is, in fact, speaking about lying in a court and what consequences that could bring down on your neighbor. don't do that. Not just because it's illegal, but also God is saying, no, that's not a fair way to treat one another. But beyond the legal implication, there's also this social implication to this commandment. It implies very clearly that our reputations can be lost in the ways that we speak to and about one another. What we really have to carry us in this world in many ways is our reputation. And this commandment is an acknowledgement that our reputations are sometimes far more fragile than we would like to consider. We can do great damage to one another without ever touching another person. Simply with the words that are spoken, whether they are true or not, we can hurt one another. And that's a perfectly fine interpretation of this commandment to be getting on with, but that would be a little boring if we stopped right there. So then we could go to the next level, which is what we've been doing with all these commandments. You turn it inside out and you say, okay, this commandment tells us not to do something. So what does it then say that we should do? If you flip it inside out, it doesn't just say don't slander, don't speak lies, but do the opposite. Use your words for building up the reputations of others. And again, this point makes sense. It's interesting to a point, but then the more you kind of chew on it, you're like, well, okay, that's a little bland. It costs us nothing to be kind to one another with the words that we speak, and it's true that we can give one another the gift of our own words, of building up one another's reputation by speaking kindly to and about one another. This makes sense. We can teach kids this lesson. They don't always hear it, but we can work on it. Martin Luther then said, all right, there's one more level to this commandment, and he takes it even further. He says, it's not enough not to slander, and it's not enough to speak kindly. But on top of that, your words and your thoughts should always function in such a way as to assume the best of others and interpret their actions and their words as generously as possible at all times. He goes on in his writings in the Larger Catechism, which you should all thank the stars you're not Lutheran, because back in the day, Lutherans had to memorize the whole Larger Catechism, and it is quite lengthy. Luther writes in there that we should palliate and garnish the reputations of others with our own, that we should cover up our neighbor's sins and infirmities, that we should excuse them, because this is what Jesus means when he tells us to do unto others as we would have them do unto us. And on one hand, I actually kind of like what Luther is trying to get at here. I can see that the social fabric of a community could be vastly strengthened by a general pattern of everyone assuming the best intention of others and acting out of that sort of high-level goodwill and kindness. I try to do this sometimes. I'm not always effective, and psychologists would tell me that's totally human. It's very, very common for people to assume the best of ourselves and our own intentions and to assume the worst of other people. That's sort of one of the ways our brains work. We're suspicious of others and we offer ourselves the benefit of the doubt. And so that's a hard pattern to break, and it's a good one to try to live into, to give others the benefit of the doubt and hope that they do that for us. But honestly, when I started to really sort of play out the consequences of what Luther is saying, I don't think this is a great, universal, all times, in every situation sort of way to interpret this particular commandment. And I think that if we really tried to live this way, offering the benefit of the doubt in every single interaction with another person, it might actually lead to some really negative consequences. Because it's a fundamentally idealistic way of functioning in this world. And it's a good sort of thing to shoot for. And also pragmatically, there are some real downsides to this. Because I think if we did this, people could get hurt along the way. And I have a few examples of this to play out. And I'm sure you can sort of come up with your own along the way. But one that was really glaring to me this week, because it was everywhere, were the impeachment hearings, right? Now, this is not a political point. This is a linguistic point that I'm trying to make here. Language is really, really malleable. Language is very flexible and it's slippery. And language can be wielded by people who are very careful with their rhetoric as either a sharp scalpel that cuts precisely, or like the vanishing cards of the magicians. Like, you see it one minute and it's gone the next. You don't quite know what they meant to say, right? And stereotypically, lawyers and politicians are known as sort of being masters of this slippery word craft in ways that are both really wonderful and sometimes we perceive as quite devious. And the impeachment hearings have been sort of a masterclass in this idea of saying things that are technically factual, but distract from a deeper truth that's really being sought after. The way that questions are phrased and posed, the kind of questions that are being asked and the answers that are allowed to be heard in that space is sort of this example of people who are trying to tell deliberate and very careful stories with the same set of information, two wildly different stories if you've been paying attention. And the problem with Luther's suggestion is that if we follow through, if we really do assume the best and rosiest intentions of everyone all the time in the words that they are speaking, I think we might find ourselves sort of hopelessly lost in a bit of a political snarl. Because there are cases in which it is not wise to simply hand over the best of intentions to someone else and the story that they are telling you. Because there are certainly cases in which our language is being used intentionally to manipulate a story to help us see the world through the way someone else would like us to see it. And I don't even actually think this is always nefarious at its core. Like, this is actually the job of the justice system, right? If you go into a court, there are two opposing sides, and each of them is tasked with presenting evidence and telling a story in such a way as to manipulate and move the judge or the jury of public opinion in one direction or another, and to be as convincing as possible. But if we assume the best, what we might do in that process is overlook what's also happening in the manipulation and the storytelling in the room, right? So it's a very interesting way to look at language as something that is slippery and constantly moving around. Now, if we move back from some of the abstractions of politics, language, I think, also has a really personal effect. And there are ways we could look at this as on sort of a person-to-person level as well. And the way that language can harm other people, and by assuming best intent, we may actually have to choose whose best intent we're really going to pursue. So one sort of common example or story that we hear around, and I know might be a personal experience for some of you in this room as well, is the story of parents and their child. Now, the parents, due to their sincerely held religious belief, find out because their child comes out to them as gay, and their parents say, you know what? That isn't what the Bible says, and we can pray the gay away, right? Now, to be very clear, this isn't how I read scripture, and that's incredibly harmful behaviors. But their pastor, their youth pastor, the parents, the family, all of this community surrounding a kid may honestly be coming out of a place of sincerely and deeply held religious beliefs. And they might genuinely think that they are doing something that is good to save the soul of their child. But the problem is that that belief and those words can wound. And we have the LGBTQ suicide rate and the teenage homelessness rates to prove that, right? There are real consequences to those words and those beliefs. And in a case like that, you can assume the best about the parents and their pastor and the other people in their community, and you can assume and try to honor what they are saying, and also someone is still being hurt, right? There is the consequence that their belief might lead to the loss of their child, whether sort of literal or metaphorical in that case. The benefit of the doubt doesn't benefit the kid. It benefits the structures that lead to real pain. Now, you could also take the example of gaslighting. Now, gaslighting is a behavior where people use their words to actually undermine other people, to make them feel like they are not, what they're seeing is not reality, right? It's a way of helping, not helping, it's a way of manipulating people into questioning their own read of reality. And what this is a sort of deeply abusive behavior, and it happens all the time in cycles of abuse, where an abuser will make their victim feel like whatever abuse they are receiving is their own fault, that they deserve to be treated that way because of who they are as a person or whatever sort of language that story begins to tell. And gaslighting is a situation in which the use of the benefit of the doubt actually makes the situation much worse. Because very often, the person who's a victim of abuse cares deeply for the person who is abusing them, right? And if you offer that person the benefit of the doubt, what you do is you fan the flames of that gaslighting behavior. You're giving their words credence, which is causing you more harm. This is a very, very painful and difficult cycle to break because of the power that those words and the benefit of the doubt can play in that. And it perpetuates, and it goes on and on and on. And I don't think that's what Luther was thinking about when he wrote his interpretation of this commandment. So while I can appreciate where he's going with it, when I read his commentary this week, it really hit me that Luther was writing from the position of being a highly educated, powerful church leader, a white man in Western Europe whose economic place was never really threatened. Because even when Luther was kicked out of one place or another, he almost always had some little local princeling to pick him up and put him in his castle and take care of him for a while. Luther's theology on this particular point works if you're a person who's already at the top of the heap. If you are a person whose words are already heard and who is already taken quite seriously, it doesn't cost you anything to offer other people the benefit of the doubt. But quite frankly, this is a pretty damaging piece of advice and a pretty damaging theology to offer to people who are experiencing oppression, whether that's economic hardship or gender discrimination or abuse or racism or ableism or anything else. If you are already in a position of not being heard, of your voice and your perspective not being taken seriously, and then you're also told on top of that to offer the generous benefit of the doubt to the people who are in any way oppressing you, that merely perpetuates a cycle rather than breaking it. So instead of Luther's interpretation, I think this is what I would say about this commandment. This commandment reminds me that for all of their ethereal nature, our words carry real weight. They carry actual power, and our words have weight, especially when we are in positions where people listen to us and take what we say seriously. Like, when I step into this pulpit on a Sunday morning, almost every week, I am keenly aware of the fact that I am going to force all of you to sit and listen to my thoughts for 15 minutes, and that you all are giving me the power and privilege of actually listening, for the most part, to what I am saying. That is something that I try really hard not to take for granted. And it's why I spend hours and hours every week working and reworking and thinking through these sermons, because I don't want to say something that isn't true because you're listening. So be careful if you are in a position of power where people take your speech seriously, to weigh your words and to weigh the consequences of your words upon others. Because words have real consequences. They can damage the reputations and the livelihoods and the psyches and, quite frankly, even the bodies of other people. So don't lie. Like, that's the baseline of this commandment. Don't lie to people. Just don't do it. And if you are in court, offer honest testimony, not just because otherwise you could go to jail for perjury, but also because it's what this commandment is telling us to do. But beyond that, take responsibility for the words that you speak and the cost that those words weigh on others. If you speak truth and it's going to be painful or hard to hear, be cautious. Ask yourself, who suffers for my words, and how will they suffer? Use your language in ways that promote good for other people, and especially use your language in ways that promote good for people whose voices are not being heard, right? If you are in a position to speak, listen to what isn't being spoken and amplify those voices. Say hard things to people who need to hear them, but do so in kindness. And don't, to the best of your ability, manipulate other people with the stories that you tell. Try to be fair in your presentation of the facts or the story as you perceive it. Don't leave things out intentionally. Don't stretch the truth in order to bring people along to your perspective. And when you do misuse your words, because we all do, apologize. Learn to say you're sorry, to listen, and to do better next time. Take responsibility for the words that you speak and the effect that they have on others, because our words are indeed powerful. Amen.